From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a suburb of Seattle, Washington, on February 29th at the Life Care Center of Kirkland. Staff met to discuss a respiratory outbreak, and within hours, a stream of ambulances was pouring in and out. What they were witnessing was the first outbreak of COVID-19 in the United States. To date, more than 50 people in that facility alone have been killed by COVID. 61% of all COVID deaths in Washington state have come in such facilities. And this is the story just about everywhere. Michigan, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, all states with roughly 60% of COVID deaths happening in nursing homes and related facilities. Nearly 90% of COVID deaths in Connecticut last week occurred in nursing homes or long-term care facilities. In New York State, more than 5,000 deaths have been recorded at nursing home and adult care facilities. But NPR reports that this could be an undercount. More data is coming in from different parts of the state. Yale epidemiologist Dr. Albert Koh says the coronavirus attack on long-term care facilities brings tears to everyone's eyes. Even in Sweden, where health leaders have advised a more open approach to society during the pandemic, COVID has devastated homes for elderly residents. Dr. Anders Tegnell said this week that Sweden thought it could keep society relatively open while locking down long-term care facilities and focusing all of the effort, or most of it, on protecting the most vulnerable. He admitted this week he's surprised at the failure to do that. He mostly blames the long-term care facilities themselves, not government policy. All of this brings up a vital question. Can society reopen, at least in part, while isolating and protecting the most vulnerable? Why has it been so difficult? What lessons can we learn? Our guests are joining us this hour, discussing the protections and plans in several local facilities, and we're going to try to answer any questions our listeners may have. Joining us for the hour, the CEO of Episcopal Senior Life is Lauren Ranaletta. Lauren, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
And medical director for Episcopal Senior Life is Dr. Brian Heppard. Dr. Heppard, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Evan.
We do expect Dr. Kim Patrone momentarily, the medical director for St. Anne's Community, but we're not reaching Kim, and so we'll keep working on that. But let me just start, and Lauren, if you could, why don't you kind of paint a picture for what Episcopal Senior Life is in terms of facility size and the services you provide?
All right. You know, part of our goal today is for me to represent our entire alliance. So
sure,
that includes all five of the nursing homes in the 2,000 beds. In terms of Episcopal specifically, we have one nursing home, and we manage three off-site assisted livings and six off-site independent living. So we have a whole menu of programs in multiple parts of town. Again, to return to the Alliance home, St. Anne's, St. John's, the Jewish home, and the Friendly home, we as an organized group, as an alliance, have been together for 25 years. We're all independent, but we're not-for-profit and very centered on the mission and what elder people need. We all run, and I don't want to carry on too long here, but we all run multiple levels of services on multiple sites.
And Lauren, one of the first questions listeners are going to have is, what have you seen with COVID in these five facilities locally?
Well, I'm proud to say on behalf of the facilities that we have done a really darn good job. Across the 2,000 beds, we have 31 cases among the residents. And then if you were to look at our staff levels, where we employ well over 4,000 people, we have 33 cases among our staff. So we have done, in my view, an exceedingly good job of working with our staff, protecting the doorways and the entrances from bringing this disease into our environments. It's been a changing situation. I think each of us would gladly say that we have no way to predict what the day will bring and where our time will be taking us.
Sure. Listeners, if you've got questions, comments, as we talk about the safety of nursing homes and elder care facilities, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Dr. Heppard, can we lock down? Let me pose it this way. There's a lot of talk in a lot of different countries, but especially this country, as we talk about a phased reopening of society, the most ardent advocates of reopening will say something like this. They'll say, let's most of us get back to life and let's protect the elderly and the most vulnerable. As if it's easy, as if you can just do that. Can we do that, Dr. Hepburn?
I think that's extremely challenging to do. What we've seen across the country, starting in Washington, as you said in the opening, and then spreading to all the states, including New York and locally, is that the virus is very stealthy. And the trouble is that asymptomatic spread is one way that this very contagious virus is spread. So people without fever, without any symptoms, can have it and then subsequently infect others. And that's why, as we've all learned, social distancing, wearing a mask, hand washing, not touching our face is so important. Those things become even more important in a nursing home setting. And we have put into place many steps to try to, you know, limit getting the virus into the facility. What we've learned is once a virus gets into a facility, it is very difficult to keep it from spreading because of those factors I just mentioned.
And what about indoor ventilation? I mean, I think as more time passes, we are finding out just how challenging it is in indoor settings compared to outdoor. It doesn't mean you can't get sick at a park. You can. It doesn't mean you can't get infected at a park. But what is the challenge in indoor settings like the ones that we see at Episcopal Senior Life, St. Anne's, and so many others?
I think it has less to do with the ventilation system, but more the proximity of people.
Okay.
Keep in mind, all of the nursing homes, assisted living facilities, they were designed to keep people socially engaged and interacting with one another because we know they're the things that help elders do well. And now, in the terms of this outbreak, we're asking staff and residents of all of our communities to isolate themselves, to distance from themselves, to wear masks. The architecture itself doesn't lend itself to basically what's needed right now in terms of COVID. But we're doing whatever we can to mitigate the disease in all of our communities.
Let me bring in Dr. Kim Patron, who's with us now, the medical director for St. Anne's Community. First of all, Dr. Patron, thanks for making time for the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good to be here.
Can you weigh in on that question as well? And again, I'm not trying to ask it sort of flippantly or dismissively of people who say things like just reopen and protect the most vulnerable. But I think that when they make those remarks, they may be forgetting or ignoring the fact that a nursing home, a senior life facility, isn't just the residents, and the people who work there don't necessarily live there. You have deliveries, you've got packages and mail. I mean, how much can you create kind of an island for these facilities from the outside world during a pandemic, Dr. Patron?
I would echo a lot of what Dr. Hubbard just said. I think it's exceedingly difficult due to, many reasons, especially, though, the fact that people can be asymptomatic and still be shedding the virus. So when you start opening up the county and have the prevalence rates go up, there's still going to be people walking around who are able to, you know, transmit the virus. And so some of those people could certainly be people that work here that have to deliver things here. And as soon as that happens, of course, the virus enters the facility. There's no way that we can really know that that staff member might have the virus short of doing daily testing, which I think that would be a wonderful thing. But the testing hasn't evolved to that sort of point of care type of test where we could say on your way into the building, you take this test, we get the result, it's negative, okay, you can come in. If we had something like that, well then, you know, creating that barrier would be much more feasible. But at this point, you know, the test, even when it's run, as expeditious as we can, it's still taking up to 24 hours frequently for us to get the test results. So, you know, you still have that 24-hour period where that staff member could be here and unknowingly passing the virus on. People say, well, don't they have PPE? How come, you know, even if they're asymptomatic, it can spread? The kind of care that we deliver in a nursing home is not the kind of care that you can social distance with. You know, people need hands-on care. They need personal care. They need things that require a nurse or a certified nursing assistant or another staff member to be very close to them, intimately close to them at times. So it's just very likely that someone with, you know, asymptomatic carriage of the virus could unknowingly bring it into the home. And then, of course, without that social distancing ability, it becomes even more difficult to keep it under wraps. So I think it would be very challenging. If the testing evolves, certainly something that could be handled in an easier way, but we're not there yet.
Well, let me ask both Drs. Petrone and Heppard then, and I'll start with you, Dr. Petrone. Are you hesitant? Are you concerned to see society moving toward reopening, given the high prevalence of COVID deaths happening in nursing homes across the country?
I think that there, as people have said over and over again, that there's no easy answer to this, right? You know, it's sort of that rock hard place position that that we're in as a society. Obviously, we have a lot of concerns about reopening and what that will mean to us. I think that we will have to potentially implement different ways of screening people. I don't know that I have a definitive answer. I think some of it will depend on the prevalence rate in our community. So, again, you know, I mean, when you watch the governor, he talks about that valve, so if the prevalence rates start going up, well, then he's going to turn the valve down and, you know, potentially start closing things again. Honestly, I think that we will have to be very vigilant of that. And as the prevalence rates go up, we will need to have frank communication with the Department of Health, with, you know, the community at large, at what this does to the most vulnerable people and the risk that it poses. And is there anything else that we could do to mitigate the risk? Is there potential for, you know, testing nursing home employees on a more frequent basis, you know, those kinds of things. So, yes, we are concerned. We are concerned, but we do understand on the other side of that fence that there are implications to keeping the community closed as well. So difficult, difficult decisions ahead of us.
Dr. Heppard?
Yeah, I think a graduated data-based reopening is what we probably will need to be doing. I think I understand that patients, our residents, and their families want to connect as soon as possible in a face-to-face way. I think we have to expect that opening of nursing homes and assisted living and senior facilities is going to be and should be at the tail end of any graduated reopening of the community. And I think our staff and employees have been very sensitive to what they're doing outside of work now to try to limit their ability to contract it, to protect themselves, their families, and the residents that they care for. And I think we're going to need to continue to do that, maybe longer than other employees and other segments of the market and the society.
Lauren Ranaletta, the CEO of Episcopal Senior Life and representing the Alliance here. One of the sometimes kind of crass kind of comments that I've seen throughout this pandemic is among those who will say things like, well, the average age of death is XYZ, and, you know, the average lifespan is only XYZ, and sort of mildly dismissive of the loss of life, of the threat to people in across our society, but especially those in nursing homes. What is your message, Lauren, to those who are, you know, people like, frankly, I'll just say Ben Shapiro, who said, look, you know, the average death in a nursing home is 81 years old and the average lifespan is around 81 years old. And it's not like people in their 30s on average are dying. What goes through your mind when you hear that, Lauren?
My first response is a personal opinion. There was an article in the Los Angeles Times just last week that really used the COVID as an example of ageism in our society. Our whole focus is on activity, on travel, on leisure. And most of society, especially younger generations, have really failed to capture the wisdom, the love, and the support that people who are either retired or are considered seniors can give back. That's a very strong personal feeling. But when you look at what we as an alliance are trying to do, we are trying to promote a new dimension for anybody that is aging. And so many of our residents, not all of the people in the nursing home, especially the cognitively impaired, but for so many of our residents in assisted living and in independent living, we're really trying to connect them to new purposes. In one of our senior living, they have adopted the junior class at Greece Arcadia High School. And it is just absolutely wonderful to see the exchange of values, of personal experiences, and the growth on both sides. So people in their senior years have much to offer society. We never, as long-term care providers and senior living providers, have that opportunity to showcase that.
Listeners, we want to turn it over to you in just a moment here. So if you've got questions or comments as we talk to leaders from local nursing homes and senior care facilities, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. We'll get to your feedback in just a second. Dr. Petrone, Dr. Heppert, I'll start with Dr. Petrone. Can you describe what is different in your facilities now during this pandemic? And I mean protocols for people coming in, people who have to work in the building, and whether residents are asking if they can get tested and what you can provide for them. Dr. Petrone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would say everything is different. The only thing that is not different is the caring at the hands of the staff who remain so committed to our elders and our passion for elder care. But pretty much operationally, we have changed so much. As Dr. Heppert mentioned, kind of what's the best for geriatric care, meaning involvement, engagement, having families involved in care, is exactly opposite of what you need to do to control a virus that is this contagious. So we really have had to shift our pendulum and rethink things from A to Z. Beginning in March, we began, obviously, with visitation restrictions. We only allow essential vendors, staff, and for residents who are at the very end of life, we do allow visitation. That is actually a short period of time every day that people are allowed to come in and visit. In addition, we also have changed the way people are coming into the building. So people have to be screened on entrance to the building, including temperature checks, as well as monitoring for any signs or symptoms that would suggest COVID illness. Everyone must wear a mask. We also have worked with the hospital systems and the Department of Health to have testing on site, both for employees as well as for our residents. Residents, I would say, have not asked a ton for the test. Certainly, if we have a high suspicion or an exposure of any sort, we do talk to them about the testing. And, you know, I would say, generally speaking, they have been pretty okay with it. We also have all kinds of protocols now for notification of families. Speaking of that, we do daily calls with our staff to keep them informed of, you know, changes that have come down from the Department of Health or other governmental arenas, as well as what's going on in the building in terms of changes. We also, here at St. Anne's, and I know at all the other Alliance homes, are communicating with our families through Zoom meetings to keep them abreast of changes, and then, of course, emailing them out. So a lot has changed. A lot of the activities that we used to, you know, do with our residents had to be modified to respect social distancing. We have really utilized a lot of platforms for Zoom, you know, Zoom or teleconferencing with families. We have used our closed-circuit TV for religious streaming. So all the activities that we were normally doing in person, we found different ways to implement them to decrease viral spread. But, you know, that really changes kind of the day-to-day ins and outs of things. And, of course, I think the largest thing that anyone working in an Alliance home would tell you is that it is very foreign not to have our families here. Our families are the lifeblood, really, of the nursing home. They provide a context for us to understand their loved one. They help us set the care plans for, you know, the residents, and they really are part of, I would say, the, you know, the care team for the residents. So not having them here has really changed the dynamic. And, you know, We have done everything we can think of to include them via, you know, via Zoom or something like that. But it feels different. So it's a quieter place. A lot more masks, a lot more gowns, those kinds of things.
Sure. And as I turn to Dr. Heppard for similar thoughts from his facility, let me also bring in a listener question, because on this note, Liz emails the following. Regarding the severely detrimental psychological effects of isolation and loneliness, might a possible solution be the use of plexiglass barriers? This idea has already been implemented for some facilities in the form of a plexiglass cubicle. There is an additional link that she's emailing showing the use of plexiglass greenhouses, which might work with slight modifications, perhaps in a courtyard setting. Wondering about your guest's thoughts on that. Dr. Heppard?
I'll just say we've implemented all the same things that Dr. Petrone mentioned. And keep in mind, a lot of this guidance as to what we were required to do came early on in March from the New York State Department of Health, the CDC, and Medicare. So there was a lot of activity in March around implementing all the things that Dr. Petrone mentioned. I think we're all very open to thinking about ways of maintaining communication with families. As Dr. Petrone said, you know, we know that families are incredibly important to the health and well-being of their loved one that's here, but also to us as staff. I think the concern still is, how do we maintain connection without having a physical presence? And I think, you know, all of us are starting to think about, as the weather gets warmer, are there ways that we might be able to do things that remain safe and still allow a bit more contact? I would be nervous as a medical director to allow someone to come into the building, to come into the enclave that we've tried to set up, be it with even a plexiglass barrier, such as we're seeing in some of the grocery stores locally.
Let's let Dr. Heppard close the loop on that, and then I'll bring Dr. Petrone back. Go ahead, Dr. Heppard.
Yeah, I was just going to say, part of that goes back to what we were saying before about asymptomatic spread. And then also what we know about this virus in terms of surfaces. You know, this virus can live for something, what we think is days, on different surfaces. Obviously, we would clean and do all those types of things, but it just feels really risky. And once the virus gets into a community, it is very, very difficult to limit its spread.
Okay, Dr. Petrone.
Oh, I was just going to add that I think that actually the Department of Health mandate is that we cannot do that. We cannot let a lot of visitors into the facility unless it's, you know, absolutely required for the health and well-being of our residents. So I'm not sure that we would even be able to do that with plexiglass. But we have here at St. Anne started window visits now that the weather is better. So we're fortunate to have beautiful, you know, floor-to-ceiling windows in certain areas of our building. And so we set up window visits whereby the resident can be brought down to the window and then talk over a phone to their family member or loved one through the window. So creativity is definitely needed, and we are looking for ways, as Dr. Heppard said, to continue to engage families.
Let me work through some more audience feedback now. Karen in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Karen.
Hi. My mom is actually over at Chapel Oaks, and we do have a window visit scheduled. But, I mean, she's not very good with computers, and we feel that she's kind of mentally slipping. And I wondered if there was anything we could have her do or try to address this situation, because she doesn't get visitors, you know, and she doesn't come out of her apartment a lot. She's kind of afraid. And I can hear it in her voice. And so I didn't know if you could suggest anything.
Karen, thank you for the phone call. Let me just go down the list. I'll start with Dr. Petrone and let all of our guests weigh in on that. Go ahead, Dr. Petrone.
Well, you know, obviously, Karen, thanks for that question. It's you know, one thing that we obviously worry about every day is what toll is this isolation or change in environment and having on our seniors and our residents. I think that the more things that you can do to just things that she enjoys to integrate those into her day, I think the window visit is a great idea. I know that sometimes integrating new technology at any age, you know, I sometimes struggle with new technology. So trying to get people to understand how to Zoom when they've never done it before and you're not allowing a lot of people to come in and do the education can be a bit of a challenge. So I understand that. I think that also working potentially, you know, I don't know if your mom's physician is part of our practice, but, you know, working with their physician to see is there other things that they could be doing to enhance their cognitive ability and keep them engaged. But it is a really challenging time, and I'm not sure that there's a singular answer for every patient. I suspect that it will be different for every person because what engages one person doesn't engage the other. You know, so it's a challenge. It's a challenge. You are probably going to be just as important in coming up with that care plan because you know your mom better than anyone else. So you can kind of come up with ideas that perhaps can stimulate her. But we do worry about depression, anxiety, and social isolation. And of course, if it gets significant, physician or nurse practitioner should be involved in sorting out what to do with that.
Dr. Heppard.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think all of the Alliance communities certainly have activities and social work staff that can assist. So if families aren't making contact with those individuals in the communities, they should. And then I would say, you know, just in terms of technology or other ways to keep, it's important that it's simple. And thankfully, FaceTime really is simple to use. I would say I've helped with a number of my patients as I've made visits with them understand how to use their technology. And there are staff in the communities that will help residents get set up for something like that if the family provides a device.
Lauren Ranaletta, CEO of Episcopal Senior Life, how concerned are you about the mental health toll that the pandemic could take?
May I ask that I just go back to the other question?
Sure.
I think
please.
Some of the other Alliance members, and this is kind of different in every case, we have gone to family video chats, and Dr. Heppard referenced it, where we have a staff member who maybe works in the billing office take a video pad to a resident's room and set it up to talk to a family member at home. So there are some things that have helped to mitigate that separation between families and their loved ones. So I would just leave that thought, and I'm sure the team here at St. Anne's can follow up on that. You know, in terms of the mental health piece, you know, I would start answering that by saying the residents in the Alliance homes are never, never, never without someone. And we have gone out of our way to make sure that a staff member has a link with the residents and helps to make that communication bridge to the family if necessary. You know, many of the people that move into senior housing or move into assisted living, there is a different kind of relationship that is formed with the staff. And it's not just a care and aid kind of thing. It really is a personal exchange. So really, on behalf of all the Alliance homes, our staff have been really coached to make the experience with the residents and the families as personal as it could possibly be.
A listener who I will not name sends a private message saying, Dr. Patrone cared for my mother while she was at St. Anne's, and my mother loved her. You can never properly thank someone who cares for your failing parent, an incredible person. Thank you for this. And so it's just so important that we figure out a way through the next, I don't know, 12, 18 months, you know, it is a long way to a vaccine. We all hope that there will be therapies, and we're all trying to figure out a way to live as a society. But the challenge to senior care facilities, nursing homes, and the like is immense, and our guests are from those communities. You just heard Lauren Ranaletta, CEO of Episcopal Senior Life, and Dr. Brian Heppard is their medical director, Dr. Kim Patrone, medical director for St. Anne's Community. On the other side of our only break, we will work through more of your questions and comments for them. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, who's eligible for what benefits during the pandemic? We zero in on SNAP benefits. We talk about who doesn't have access to food, how to change that. That's a problem always. pandemic or not, but it has become even more acute now, and we'll talk about who's getting the help, how they're getting the help, and what you need to know Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. An email comes addressed from a concerned child of a nursing home resident, and it's one of several that have explored this subject, and I will at least let Lauren Radaletta, CEO of Episcopal Senior Life and representing the Alliance, address if he likes. So here's the email. Will you be exploring the recent investigation into the Hurlbut in Brighton? Specifically, listeners are curious about why residents who have COVID-19 are kept in nursing homes with those who do not, in light of the awareness that social distancing is nearly impossible in these settings. And another question has to do with the capability of nursing homes to actually treat the virus rather than merely offer end-of-life or comfort care. Again, that's from a concerned child of a nursing home resident, and I'll turn that over to Lauren Radaletta.
You know, I am happy to represent the concerns of the Alliance and can speak ever so clearly and confidently of how we approach things. It's very difficult to reach out and put yourself in someone else's shoes. I think this is going to be a horrible analogy, and I'll probably be kicked for it, but you have all kinds of grades of hotels. You have chains that are managed in multiple sites, and then you have boutique, high, five-star ratings. And I think what you will see in the nursing home industry is just a wide variety of mission or concerns or purpose. And, you know, again, I think this alliance came together because all five of us believe that it's the quality of life of the resident that comes first. It is not the dollar signs. It is not the health department survey results. It's like, are we making a difference for residents and their families? It's just, you know, once again, negative information flows so much faster and so much wider than all the good things that are happening. And, you know, the consumer has no options. So it's a complicated question that was asked, and I would just like to keep it on the high road.
Okay, well, here's what I think is not complicated. Listeners may be wondering about all of your facilities. If someone has COVID-19 in your facility, what's happening with that patient?
Oh, my goodness. If that were the case, everyone would know about it. Families would be immediately told. There would be daily emails. We're doing weekly calls with all the families at all of our levels of care. So we have opened up a communication link as one of our major initiatives of staff time. And I think the transparency to the families and the transparency to our staff and the education is what's building the trust.
But I'm trying to make sure I understand, Lauren, if someone is diagnosed, is positive with the virus or has COVID-19, are they staying in your facility or are they going elsewhere?
They are staying in the facility.
Okay.
I'm going to pass it to Brian.
Yeah, Dr. Hepper, you want to add to that, please?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so many of the residents that live in nursing homes especially obviously have many chronic diseases, they're advanced disease, they're frail, otherwise they wouldn't be living with us. As medical providers, even before COVID, we routinely talk with patients and their families about what their wishes are if they get extremely sick, right? So they have advanced directives in place. So many of our patients have predetermined, even before COVID, that they don't want to go to the hospital if they became gravely ill. And so just like we would before COVID, we're respecting those wishes and we're trying to treat them in place. It is important that the caller or emailer knows there is no effective treatment for COVID. The care is all supportive. So even if someone elects to go to the hospital, the treatments that they can get there that aren't easily given in the nursing home are really intubation and high-level respiratory support. We can provide pain medicine. We can provide extra oxygen. We can provide intravenous fluids if that would help them. So there's many things that we can do and will do and are doing in the nursing home. It's just those highest level interventions like being on a ventilator that we obviously can't do here. But again, many of our residents have already predetermined that they don't want those interventions at this point in their life. So we respect that and treat them here.
What about some kind of quarantine within the facility, though, Dr. Heppard? What kind of separation is happening?
Yep. So each nursing home has figured out a plan to try to cohort both residents and staff. Obviously, that has a lot to do with the architecture of each community and the size. But each community does have a plan to cohort as best they can and quarantine as best we can.
Looking at the numbers, at least going back a couple of weeks, April 20th, Spectrum News reported that at the time there were 10 COVID-19-related deaths within these five homes, including 8 from St. John's, and that there have been at least 36 residents, 27 employees who had tested positive for COVID-19 in the Alliance homes. Lauren, I think you mentioned earlier, what's the number of total residents who've tested positive?
All right. Our numbers as of yesterday were 31 confirmed resident cases and 33 staff cases.
33 staff. Okay. So, Dr. Patron, if one of your staff has COVID, I mean, I assume that's a couple weeks not coming into the facility at minimum there. Is that right?
That's correct. That's a minimum of 14 days. It could be longer depending on how their illness presents and their symptoms.
Okay. And if one of your staff has it, are you sort of doing your own contact tracing to say who have you been with and are they all going to get tested? Mm-hmm. Does that happen?
So we work very closely with the Department of Health when we realize that someone that worked here has the virus. I think all the Alliance homes operate in a very similar way. And we are fortunate that with the size of our nursing home, we are able to do contact tracing ourselves with, of course, assistance from the Department of Health. So we can then go and figure out which residents the staff member might have cared for and what sort of department or people they might have had the closest contact with. And then, again, test those people to try to, you know, mitigate any spread. But again, we are working closely with the Department of Health, both Monroe County Department of Health and the State Department of Health when we do realize that. And they do guide us. And they also do a lot of follow-up with those staff members, teaching them about, you know, isolation once they're taken out of the workforce and, you know, how to best protect their own family and the people out in the community that they might be in touch with.
We have listeners who wonder if someone is testing positive and is in one of your facilities. I know the policies at hospitals and I understand the policies, but this is one of the hardest things when family members cannot make contact and they're wondering, okay, why don't you gear us up with PPE and then we can go to the resident's bedroom only? You know, we'll come in fully in PPE, head to toe, and then we can go visit in a resident's bedroom. Is there any chance that's going to happen, Dr. Patron?
I completely understand how hard this is to be separated. I mean, it is just excruciating not to be able to see someone that you love and for such a long time, and also to not know exactly when it's going to end. There's, you know, it's sort of this floating end date depending on what happens in the community. And I agree with Dr. Hubbard that we will probably be the last of the group to open. The problem with the PPE is, well, first of all, while the shortage is much less challenging at this point, there is always a concern about, you know, having enough of it at any given time. Second of all, donning and doffing PPE is not as easy as one might think. You can very easily contaminate yourself if you are not very, very well educated about how to put it on and how to take it off. And you really need to be taught. So in order to implement that, you know, that would be a massive education undertaking. And, you know, in some of our facilities where you have 300 or more residents, to try to sort of pull that off and get everyone educated and then continue to make sure that they're properly educated and doing it correctly, I think it leaves a lot of liability. I think that While there would be tremendous benefit in that, I'm almost certain that someone might do it wrong, could do it wrong, and there you go. You've got the virus in your facility, and you have catastrophic effects from that. So, it's a very challenging decision to make, but I think I'm not confident that we would be able to get people to do it well enough, consistently enough, that we could keep the virus out.
Okay. Dr. Heppert, agree?
I do agree. It is important to note, though, that the regulations do allow, and all of our communities have made accommodations for family visitation at the end of life. So if someone were to get COVID and they chose to be treated and they, if they were going to die from that illness, the facility would allow them to come in. We would teach them how to put on that protective gear, and we would allow a visit in those circumstances. They're the only circumstances that we're allowed to allow visits by the Department of Health.
Jillian is asking, Dr. Heppert, I'm still frustrated to hear that nursing homes in Monroe County are not testing all of the residents. Why not all of them? Dr. Heppert?
Yep. So I think mass testing of residents or staff it is somewhat problematic. So we may ultimately get to that. So there has been difficulty having test capacity in the community to do that across all of the residents and staff in all of the nursing homes across the county. But even if testing were to go up, so let's say we tested everyone in a nursing home today. If we tested all of the residents and all of the staff today, that would give us reassurance for that moment in time only. Because if a staff member then went to Wegmans later that night or the grocery store or got pumped gas, they very well could pick it up that very night and come into work the next day and be asymptomatic. So it only tells us for a very short period of time, that you're safe. And it could sort of conversely provide a sense of false reassurance, and people might then let down their guard, which obviously would not be good.
Yeah, I take that point. Let me continue with listener feedback. I'm going to read a comment here, and then I'm going to go to the phones. If you're on the phones, Mike, Jane, we'll get to you in just a second. Dave says, early on, I recall the governor telling nursing homes that they had to take residents back from hospitals or lose their licenses. Now he's saying they shouldn't have if they couldn't care for them, and threatening to take their licenses. This feels like unfair treatment of nursing homes. Lauren Ranaletta, is that an accurate description of what's been going on?
I think it was an important misstep that state government took, and I would describe it as a diligent effort to help the backlogged hospitals in New York City that precipitated that order. And it's been devastating to the downstate nursing homes. We've had multiple peer calls where 60, 70, 80 people have been lost in certain homes. When you come to the Monroe County or the Finger Lakes experience, we do not have a hospital system that's overwhelmed. And we have a regional task force that is really trying to look at, if the hospitals got backed up, could we set up a COVID-only unit, for example, in a vacant wing of some place or in an adult daycare center? So there has been very active planning in Monroe County and the Finger Lakes for how we would handle something. We're fortunate, again, that our hospital system has not been overwhelmed, and we are managing the situation very, very well.
Okay, back to the phones we go. Mike in Rochester next. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, I have a comment and two quick questions. First of all, I'd like to say that I had a mother who was both in an assisted living facility and in a nursing home, and I have nothing but high praise for the staff of both of these facilities. And I think somehow, and I think that the press has given nursing homes a bad rap, okay, and some of the politicians. The question that I have is that how many people – in a typical year, say 2019 or 2018, die in nursing homes? Because I know, because I had a mother who died in a nursing home a few years ago. So how many deaths per year typically occur in nursing homes, number one? And number two, when they report the deaths in the hospital, does that include people who came from nursing homes that went into the hospital that died, or are the numbers that are reported for nursing home deaths reported in the nursing home, isolated from the hospital?
Yeah, so, all right, Mike, thank you. So first of all, Lauren Randalata, if you have a resident who gets sick and ends up on a ventilator in a hospital and then passes away, does that count as a nursing home death?
No, that would be a hospital death.
Okay. Okay, I can understand the confusion some people have may have over that.
I believe Dr. Hepper does have a lot more community information about that. So
okay, Dr. Hepper?
So the national statistics about nursing homes is about a third, somewhere between a third and 40% of a nursing home population will die each year. And again, that speaks to, I think, what this caller was suggesting is, you know, this, it's a frail population to begin with.
Okay. All right. Let me just try to get through as much as I can here. Erica says, I'm a staff member at St. Anne's, and I want to commend Dr. Patron for her leadership and action during this pandemic. As part of the staff, I know there are specific steps taken to ensure everyone's safety, and it may be good to describe or to outline the plan in a little bit more detail for the public in order to help them view us in a better light. And in my opinion, we should stop focusing on the number of cases. Focus on an explanation of how the plans work. Dr. Patron?
I think each of the Alliance homes has done a tremendous job in, sort of coming up with a unique plan that fits their community the best way possible to decrease exposure. I can speak, you know, obviously best to St. Anne's. Early on, we found that there was a lot of confusion over what PPE you needed in particular circumstances. So we have a color-coded system that we have used since the beginning, and we've kind of hardwired that color coding so that staff know when they see that color, this is the PPE you must don. Again, we have daily communication with our staff at 1 o'clock, where we go through the whole building, what's happening, what has changed in terms of federal mandates or state mandates. And I think just generally being out and about and answering questions, we do have, as Dr. or Lauren had mentioned, one of the callers questioned why we do keep people in the nursing home. And Dr. Hubbard eloquently went through that, you know, our mission has always been and always will be to serve the elders and their desires around their health care. So if they choose to stay here with COVID, we certainly will honor that, understanding that we had to make changes within our nursing home to accommodate that and keep all of the other residents safe. So in all of the communities, changes have occurred. Here at St. Anne's, we have what we call a rule out unit. So if you are coming into our community from anywhere else outside of this building, you spend 14 days on our rule out unit because that's the incubation period. If you are fine within those 14 days, then you can move to your final destination home. But you are not allowed to sort of leave your room on that rule out unit. The staff wear full PPE. We have no communal activities really. And the focus is really keeping you in as much isolation as possible, of course, while attending to your psychosocial needs through other means, as again, Skyping, Zooming, all those things. And then we do have a dedicated COVID unit, and that unit is separated physically from all of our other units. We have a closed staff model. Those staff do not float anywhere else in the building. And, you know, even when we're in a staffing crisis or crunch, I would say, they don't migrate to any other place. In addition, we have put a shower in for our staff so that when they leave, they are, you know, able to kind of feel confident when they leave this building that they're not tracking any of the virus back home. We've had enhanced pay for them, again, because it's a little daunting to take care of the virus and all of the PPE and all the extra things that you need to do. We have dedicated equipment on that unit, so we have brought in new oxygen concentrators, suction machines. They don't go anywhere else in the building. They stay right there. So I think, again, I can understand why people are worried about keeping COVID positive residents in the nursing home. If that's what they want, that's our mission. But we have obviously adapted our nursing home to accommodate that. It isn't just that they stay in their room and, you know, we continue business as usual. So I want the public to understand that we have really tried to do both. We've tried to honor elders' wishes And we feel like it's obviously that's the right thing to do. And we also feel like we're medically and from a nursing perspective able to do that and keep the rest of our people safe. So I think that each community has handled that in its own specific way, but that's the sort of the St. Anne's means for doing it.
I hope you will all come back and continue conversations with us because we couldn't get to all the listener feedback. I know families have questions, and I know you're working really hard to be transparent with them because the pandemic doesn't end tomorrow or next week or next month. And so it'll be a long road, and I know it's a lot of work, but I want to thank our guest for being with us, the CEO of Episcopal Senior Life, Lauren Radaletta. Thank you, Lauren. Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Dr. Brian Heppard, Medical Director for Episcopal Senior Life. Thank you, Dr. Heppard.
Thanks for your interest, Evan.
And Dr. Patrone, Dr. Kim Patrone is Medical Director for St. Anne's Community. Thank you, Dr. Patrone.
You're quite welcome. Thanks.
And for your staffs, we got lots of emails from people who are just really grateful for the kind and caring work day-to-day in a pandemic and outside of a pandemic. You can pass that along to your staffs. We also want to pass along a farewell and a big thank you to Emma Ray Stein, longtime Connections intern, last day today. Really one of the best, and a big, bright future for her. Thank you so much for the wonderful work, Emma Ray Stein. For the whole team at Connections, Emma Ray, Megan Mack, producer, Rob Braden, engineer, hope you have a peaceful weekend. We'll talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.